We are the oldest in the city, founded in 1754. The intervening 261 years have made the library one of New York City's enduring institutions and cultural oases. This is possible because of the many members and friends who lend their support above and beyond membership fees. Please give generously as possible to the library's annual fund, so the library can continue to build the collection, maintain this beautiful building, and present its wide-ranging programs. Thank you for your support. I'm Jenny Lawrence, a longtime member and former trustee of the library, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Andrew Oliver, who will talk about his book this evening, American Travelers on the Nile, Early U.S. Visitors to Egypt, 1774 to 1839. Drew, also a former library trustee, grew up in the city and holds degrees from Harvard and the Institute of Fine Arts at NYU. He was curator in the Greek and Roman Department of the Metropolitan before moving to Washington in 1982 to become director of the museum program at the National Endowment for the Arts. Since retirement, he has added to his published work on subjects from ancient glass, jewelry, silver, and pottery to the archaeology of the Eastern Mediterranean. And now this astonishingly rich book of firsthand accounts of American travelers on the Nile. Given the difficulties and uncertainties of visiting Egypt today, you may well prefer the armchair style of travel. In fact, some of the armchairs are occupied tonight in this splendid reading room as we join the American travelers of two centuries ago discovering the glories of Egypt. Should you have made the journey at the time, you would have entered a fascinating and unfamiliar world. After disembarking in Alexandria and 10 days of quarantine, you would sign in with the U.S. consular agent John Glidden before gazing up at Pompey's Pillar or having an audience with the Pasha and a tour of his gardens. Then up to Cairo by Hanja, a 70-foot long boat fitted with two large lateen sails via the Mamouja Canal. You would probably go by donkey, Franks, as Christians were called, weren't permitted horses, out to the Great Pyramid, where Napoleon was reputed to have told his troops, from the heights of these pyramids, 40 centuries look down upon you. Next, your dragoman, or translator, would lead you up the Nile to see Seti I's tomb by moonlight, the excavations at Karnak, or the catacombs at Giza. You might, we shudder at the thought today, carve your initials in a temple stone and pocket a small antiquity or two as a souvenir. While the first Americans to visit Egypt in 1774 was Nicholas Ward Boylston from Boston, many subsequent travelers were from New York, possibly members of our library. Drew reports that regardless of the mode of travel, by armchair or in person, interest in Egypt was high. Drew looked through 3 years of our library's ledgers between 1789 and 1792 and discovered more than 30 readers had charged out Claude Savary's Letters on Egypt and the Comte de Volney's Travels Through Syria and Egypt, while 125 took out James Bruce's Travels to Discover the Source of the Nile. So now, please turn off your cell phones and join me in welcoming Drew Oliver, who will take us armchair travelers back in time to the land of the Nile.
Thank you, Jenny, for your very kind information and for not giving too much away. I should begin by asking myself the question, how did I come to write a book on American travelers in Egypt in the first half of the 19th century? I'm not an Egyptologist. So how did it come about? Well, the story goes back almost 50 years when I was a junior curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, just over here. And I have to pause for a moment because who with colleagues at the Harvard Medical School have conducted a survey of more than 100 Harvard College graduates beginning some 40 or 45 years ago, asking them detailed questions about their lives, recording all of their answers, and continuing to ask them similar questions up until the present day. And of course, they discovered, as you would discover yourself, that what you say today about an event in your life that took place 50 years ago is quite different from what you reported 50 years ago when you were speaking to this same body of people. So you have to, don't believe everything I tell you about in to put this book together. In any event, in 1968, from my office window at the Metropolitan Museum, I had an unobstructed view of Central Park, the buildings on Central Park West. And in 1968, I also had an unobstructed view of the stone blocks from the Temple of Den Dur, which had been disassembled, loaded on the SS Concordia Star, taken to New York as part of the arrangement between the Egyptian government and the United States government for ultimate reassembly here at the Metropolitan Museum. And those of you who know the museum know that the Temple of Den Dur is fully displayed in a wonderful space at the northern end of the museum. Now, I knew from a little bit of reading that I'd already done in the mid-1960s that travelers, mostly British and Italian and French, but a few Americans, carved their names on the monuments as they went up the Nile. So I went down and had by arrangement with the Egyptian department to look at the blocks. And one of the names I found was L. Bradish, N.Y., 1821. Luther Bradish, a New Yorker, had been on a diplomatic mission to Constantinople in 1821 to try to negotiate a treaty with the Sultan. He was unsuccessful, and afterwards he took a short trip on the Nile. Later on in life, Bradish served as Lieutenant Governor of New York State, and he was a long-time president of the New York Historical Society. I found it extraordinary that the name he carved in Egypt should come home to Central Park. And about the same time, in the 1960s, I began to study the stories of 18th and 19th century travelers' accounts to the Eastern Mediterranean. Most of them were British, English, French, Italians, Russians, but a few were American. And I came to know the bibliography. And I also came to understand, in reading a book by David Finney, who was an executive and lawyer for Mobil Oil, who after his career with Mobil Oil, wrote a book for Harvard University Press, published in 1967, just about a year before I saw the temple blocks of Den Dur. He published a list of Americans who had signed the consular register of John Glidden, as Jenny Lawrence pointed out to us in the introduction. From the time that John Glidden was, he was an English merchant, but he served as American consul. There were some 40 or 50 Americans who signed the register from 1832, when Glidden was appointed consul, to 1842. And then a decade later, 1978, I purchased from a New York bookseller, still in business on 59th Street, just off Lexington Avenue. Some of you may know the shop, one of the longest running bookshops in New York. I purchased a diary, a manuscript diary, kept by a young Columbia College graduate, class of 1834, on a trip he made to Egypt in 1839, 120 pages of closely written manuscript. His name was Philip Rhinelander, a very good name in New York. But his name was not on the consular register, Glidden's consular register. But in looking over the diary, I realized that he was traveling with Messrs. Whitlock, Tucker, and Cram, whose names were on the consular register. And we will come back toward the end of my remarks to one of his in my research, oh, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I knew that the earliest American, as David Finney had pointed out, to go to Egypt was the Connecticut Yankee John Ledyard. He was an extraordinary traveler. He had attended Dartmouth College. He traveled with Captain Cook to the Sandwich Islands on the third voyage. He'd written a book about the experiences. He then went to Russia. He started walking across Russia to investigate the fur trade until Catherine the Great had him expelled. In Paris, he became known to Thomas Jefferson. Ledyard arrived under the African Association of London in Alexandria in 1788 with the express purpose of exploring the Nile Valley and that region of Africa. But he died in Cairo, mission unaccomplished. But up until that point, he was the first American to go. And I knew the exploits in 1804 of William Eaton of the US Navy and Presley O'Bannon of the US Marines, who were taking part in the so-called Barbary Wars. They picked up a deposed ruler of what is now Libya in Alexandria and got him put back in place, to be more favorable to the Americans, put back in place in Libya. And this, of course, is one of the famous episodes of the Barbary Pirates, gave rise to the phrase "to the shores of Tripoli."
Hmm.
Now, in 1798, Napoleon's invasion of Egypt and the savants that he brought with him to study everything about Egypt, flora, fauna, modern customs, pharaonic ruins, the savants stayed on in Egypt after Napoleon left for some 3 years. They published their findings in a sequence of folio volumes over a period of years from, say, 1810 to 1825. It's probably the largest publication, if you count all the volumes together in one, that was ever done. It's also one of the heaviest. I weighed sample volumes, and it comes out at in excess of 500 pounds. There is a set in this library. I hope Wells supported at some point. But Egypt was ultimately transformed not by the West's understanding of what Napoleon brought to their attention, but by a man named Mehmet Ali. He was a Turkish-speaking Ottoman from what is now northern Greece, who came to Egypt with the blessing of the Sultan in 1801 to help the British get rid of the French. And he stayed on. And 5 years later, in 1806, by shrewd maneuvering, he was able to set himself up as a pasha, virtually independent of the Sultan in Constantinople. And a few years after that, he took it upon himself to gather several hundred of the leading Mamluk nobles and notables in Cairo and surrounding. The Mamluks were the hereditary dynasties of the 18th century, and he had them massacred so that he would be assured of no competition. And he then set about modernizing Egypt with the help of expatriate British, French, and Italian of every description. So he redid the military, everything to do with medicine. He worked on all kinds of the aspects of the infrastructure of Egypt over a long period of time. Mehmet Ali was pasha from essentially 1805 well into the 1840s, and he established a dynasty which continued unbroken by direct descent for 10 generations until a man some of you will remember, who was overthrown or abdicated in 1952, namely King Farouk. King Farouk was his direct descendant, 10 generations down. And King Farouk's son, who was a small boy at that point, then went and lived in Geneva. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal not so long ago talking about King Fahd, who doesn't prefer to have himself called anything to do with Egypt, but he is allowed back in Egypt. And it's curious that the Egyptians themselves looked with some longing on that period, because I discovered that there was a soap opera set up not so long ago called Farouk, so that they could sort of relive part of that era. Now, in 1832, jumping ahead here a bit, became it much it easier to travel in. Because in that year, Thomas Waghorn, and I talk about this in the book, who was a former British naval officer, decided to set up a mail route from Falmouth to India that went through Egypt. In other words, through Gibraltar, Malta, Alexandria, Cairo, Suez, and then to Bombay, 6,000 miles instead of 16,000 miles around Africa. And what Waghorn did is he established hotels for people to stay in Alexandria. He got boats for them to go up the Mamoudia Canal and the Nile to Cairo. He arranged camels and way stations for them to go over to Suez, more hotels, where they got on the steamer in the passage to India. Men, women, and children, as well as the matter. And Americans took part, and they took advantage of these new amenities. Now, as I mentioned, apart from Ledger, who was an explorer, not a tourist or a traveler, and O'Bannon and Eaton, who were military adventurers in 1804, Americans did not come to Egypt until after the end of the War of 1812. Treaty of Ghent, 1814, allowed Americans to travel abroad. They had not been able to for some 3 or 4 years, and the British to go the other way. And at that point, Americans began to flood into Western Europe. Now, among the American travelers that I found were rich, young college graduates from Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and schools in Charleston. They were in search of adventure. They went beyond the Grand Tour. They were also officers of ships of the Mediterranean Squadron, stationed on Menorca, who showed the flag sailing clockwise around the Mediterranean. And then in addition, there was a doctor looking at medical facilities, a doctor from New York, a biblical archaeologist from Boston and later New York looking at tourist items in Egypt before he went on to catalog Palestine. And there was a gentleman bringing steam-driven equipment to help the Pasha with rice and cottonseed. And lastly, there was one gentleman, two of them actually, who were on hand to collect giraffes from the menagerie in New York. And in the book, there is an illustration of a giraffe. Not the one that went to New York, but the one that went, I believe, to Paris, because giraffes were given diplomatic presents by Mehmet Ali to the King of England, France, Vienna, etc. Now, I did a little calculation. Very few people went to Egypt, I said. My rough calculation said if 1,000 Americans went to Paris, 100 of those went to Italy, Rome or Florence. And of those, perhaps 6 or 7 went to Malta and Greece, and maybe 1 or 2 to Egypt. They went either clockwise down the Danube to Constantinople or counterclockwise from Marseille to Malta. When I say 1,000 Americans in Paris, there were probably 20,000 British in Paris. So the Americans were always the minority. Now, before I began my work, when looking at David Finney's 1967 Harvard University Press book, there were 10 accounts available in either published books or unpublished diaries of Americans going to Egypt in the period that I cover, roughly 1825 to 1840. In the course of my work, I found 14 more unpublished, unknown diaries, letters, and newspaper articles sort of buried in the archives. And one of these I found turns out to be the first American to go to Egypt, namely Ward Nicholas Oilston, whom Jenny had mentioned, who was a Bostonian who was fleeing, on the one hand, an unhappy marriage, and on the other hand, the looming war of American independence, because he was a loyalist. And he went abroad with a friend and went to Smyrna, Baalbek, Jerusalem, and Egypt in 1774, wrote a remarkable day-by-day diary, which was given to the Massachusetts Historical Society some 20 years ago, and essentially nobody has looked at it. mentioned to some of you that a good place to begin in my work, and possibly end my work, is the chapter on the Mediterranean Squadron. Commodore Daniel Patterson was one of these officers who made a tour with his family, his wife and three daughters, in 1834. We know something about this because the chaplain wrote a book on the subject, and one of the daughters published an article in American newspapers on her visit to the harem. But until I visited the Nimitz Library at the U.S. Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis, nobody realized that the two younger daughters had also been to the harem, which talk about their exploits there. And I might just, I'll just read a little bit. When I read from the book, I promise you I'm reading what the people who traveled wrote. I'm not reading what I wrote. And I'll just read a little bit of this. This is, Eliza Patterson, she's 19 years old. That night we did not sleep at all. We retired at 11, but all the animals, the dromedaries, horses, mules, and donkeys, say nothing of the Arabs themselves, had been brought to Mr. Glidden. This is the son of Mr. Glidden in Alexandria. John Glidden was the consul in Alexandria, the chief place. His son, George, was consul in Cairo. And most of the members of the squadron, the officers of the squadron, were put up in his house, in a very large house. We brought to Mr. Glidden all the animals. We ready as the baggage was to be loaded on before we were up. They made such a dreadful noise that scarcely no one in the house closed their eyes. At 2 o'clock we rose, and at 4 most of the party were on their way. The distance was only 10 miles, and we walked our horses the whole way so as not to fatigue ourselves at all previous to ascending the pyramid. We seated ourselves beneath this stupendous wood, the Pyramid of Cheops, the wonder of the world. We remained in silent contemplation, interrupted now and then by the acclamation of my God, what calm. Then we all assembled. Then they were hauled up. There were 27 officers and the three girls. Mrs. Patterson declined to go up, but the girls were hauled up. An Arab would take each arm, and they'd be pulled up the steps, and they screamed, and they tried to get rid of them, and finally Eliza Patterson beat them off and persuaded one of the officers to help her. But they got up at the top, and they wrote letters in the top, and they carved their names. Now, we talk about the beginning of my book, roughly, after the end of the war of 1812, the people I found, they really began coming in 1825. But I wanted to stop. I mean, I made a list so I have some sense of the context of how many Americans went to Egypt over a long period of time. I decided to stop with a general introduction of steamship travel across the Atlantic and with the introduction of photography. Those two things changed matters enormously. And I will just discuss two young Americans who were in Egypt in the fall of 1838 and the spring of 1839. This is the very end of my account. One was a 20-year-old young woman from Brooklyn whose diary I found unrecognized, unknown, in the Brooklyn Historical Society about 3 years ago. Her name was Susan Holmes. She sailed from New York on May 1st, 1838, with friends of her family, Mr. and Mrs. Nathaniel Littleton, and another young woman her age, on the packet ship Siddons, bound for Liverpool. And I discovered in reading newspaper accounts that Philip Rhinelander, who wrote my diary, I call it my diary, it's called Rhinelander's diary, sailed on the same day from New York to Liverpool on the very same ship. And I discovered that 83 Americans sailed from New York on that day, on the Siddons, two other packets, and the Sirius, the first British steamship, the first steamship to cross the Atlantic, racing with the Great Western. dawned on me. They were going to witness the festivities surrounding the coronation of Queen Victoria. And at least 1,000 Americans, probably many more than that, were in London during that period in the spring of 1838. Susan kept a diary the whole time she was away, the day she left or the day she came back. And it was a diary that she really wrote for herself. It wasn't that at home to Mummy. It was her own diary. So she says a lot of things in the diary. And in Vienna, they took the clockwise route. They're going down the Danube on a sequence of Austrian steamers. She and Mr. Littlefield went alone. They left Mrs. Littlefield and the other woman at home. So here was a young 20-year-old traveling with a much older man. And I realized that he was her chaperone. Until reading on the diary, I realized that, no, she was taking him. I suspect he had consumption, he had tuberculosis, and they were going to Egypt to see whether it would help his health. I will read one passage that she wrote. She got a boat in. She got a boat in. Cairo, you sink the boat to get rid of the vermin, you raise it, you dry it out, you got the sails on, you hire the crew, you bring in food, and you fly the flag of your nation from thence. And sometimes it was hard to find the flag. So here's what Susan wrote. Spent the whole afternoon and evening in a new species of handiwork, manufacturing the flag of my nation. But the Star Spangled Banner we love is certainly very pretty, and I do love it very much. And I could not help wishing there were more stripes and fewer stars. And that was very hard to make. And I'll leave it there. Philip Rhinelander. Did what many American tourists and other tourists did once they reached Cairo. They dressed up. They dressed up in local Turkish or Egyptian costume. And Philip did that too. And he says in his diary, I now put on for the first time my costume, which I had bought in Cairo. It is the nazim, or regenerated dress of the Turk. It consists of wide pants gathered around the waist in thick folds, which hangs a little below the knees. From thence downward, they are tight-fitting, close to the leg, like a gaiter. He talks about quite a bit more. And he says, on my head, I wear the tarbush, and on my feet are the double Turkish slippers, the inner of yellow, the outer of red Morocco. Thus arranged, I wander on the banks, or in Arab villages, staring and stared at. I might almost pass for a real Turk, were it not for my spectacles. And I found in the family of a descendant, a collateral descendant of Philip, a miniature that had been painted of him probably the year he graduated from Columbia College in 1934. The image is in the book. It shows a wonderful young man, quite handsome. Now, people have asked me, why did these travelers go to Egypt? But they were looking at pharaonic ruins, and Philip Randall marvels at some of the ruins. But they were also looking, I think, for stories that they could tell back home the rest of their lives. And I say that I'll read this passage from Philip. With one of his friends, I don't know whether it was Tucker or Whitlock or Cram, we set out to return to our boat alone and wandering over fields, their uniformity unbroken by a single tree, we lost our way and wandered for about 2 hours, not knowing whither to direct our steps. While traversing the plain, we were suddenly arrested by someone who called loudly upon us. We looked around and saw seated on a fast donkey, a dark-looking Arab dressed in rich costume, with robe of silk and streaming turban, and bearing before him on the pommel of his saddle a most suspiciously ugly gun to which he pointed. Gradually approaching near to us, and he continuing his address in Arab, I grasped my Newton club. I waited patiently for the issue of this scene. He halted within a few yards of us, and with a grim smile raised his gun, and pointing it towards us, showed us, suspended from the muzzle, a fine, fat hare, which he had just shot, and which he wished us to purchase. We declined, however, unable to bargain in Arabic. We then separated peacefully, he galloping toward the town, and we continuing the search for Oppo. I was disappointed at this result. Every circumstance had promised an adventure, and then so quiet a conclusion was so bad. If one cannot be robbed or murdered, why should you leave Italy? Then while he was in London, in 1794, he was still in London, he came back to Boston in 1800, but in 1794, he met John Quincy Adams, who was his second cousin. Adams was on the way to be minister in The Hague. And Adams wrote in his diary, "Dined with Mr. Ward N. Boylston in Barnard's Inn, where he kept Bachelor's Hall. My dinner was properly American, consisting of salt fish and beefsteak after the manner of our country. Boylston is a little of the virtuoso as usual. Showed me several curiosities in his possession, gave us some of the genuine water of the Nile, which was clear as crystal. Boylston's conversation is entertaining. He had traveled into the Holy Land and gave us quite an amusing account of his pilgrimage." So there he was dining out on his travels almost 20 years after he had made them. And I have the sense, and I know for a fact, that some of the other travelers did the same. Now, I will end my remarks by talking a little bit about Mr. Cram, who was one of the four travelers, I think named three of them, who went with Philip Brandon. They're all named in his diary. And one of these, a man we are very well informed about, was Henry Augustus Cram. Henry Augustus Cram, we know something about Henry Augustus Cram because he married well, he had many children, his children became friends of Edith Wharton. And the diarist, George Templeton Strong, who wrote a huge diary now owned by the New York Society Library, published in the 1950s or 1960s in four large volumes, just excerpts. George Templeton Strong wrote this about Henry Augustus Cram. We don't have Cram's diary in Egypt. I wish we did. He said, Strong was a member of a law firm that his father had founded, Strong and Bidwell. We're to have a new student, on the technical sense of the term, the distinguished individual, Mr. Augustus Cram. I'm afraid, however, he has probably addicted himself to the law merely as a gentlemanly way of doing nothing. And we probably shan't be troubled with him for more than half an hour per diem after the first fortnight. He's a graduate of Princeton, and the reputation he bore there was that of a very talented, lazy, conceited, overbearing puppy. He's a travel gentleman withal, recently returned from the grand tour of Constantinople, Mesopotamia, and Chinese Tartary, besides, for all I know. And when he got back, he said he thought New York quite too contracted. This infatuated youth seems to be making a desperate effort to raise a mustache, but I doubt the ultimate success. But then 4 months later, Strong had this opinion. Cram, I think, is not the despicable character I supposed him to be. Notwithstanding his mustache, his distingué air, and the exquisite cut of his coat, he's decidedly intelligent, very well informed in matters that can be drawn from books, And what is a rare merit, he has gathered knowledge for himself by traveling with his eyes open. So this says something about why you travel. Now, I will strong had one more thing to say about Prem, rather, several decades later. After Cram's death, he says, Henry Augustus Cram comes in for a quarter of a million. He will doubtless give up the legal practice altogether. He is finally very rich, but I regret to say that prosperity has developed his bad traits and made him insufferable, purse-proud, arrogant, and dictatorial, lavishing evil speaking beyond all example. He describes every man he don't like and he likes but few as being simply an unmitigated brute, scoundrel, thief, pirate. Generally knows, yes sir, knows what he's telling you to be true, that he ought to be in the state prison for fraud, rape, or perjury. These views he likes to set forth in rather impassioned dinner table harangues, as if he were practicing for his next jury. Well, shortly after that appeared in Strong's diary, Cran became a trustee of this library. I'm sure he was on the best day. They were members, Cram and Strong were members of a wonderful law firm. It went through several different names, Bidwell and Strong to begin with, but after three prominent lawyers joined the firm shortly after the turn of the century, it changed its name to Cadwallader, Wickersham & Taft, and is the longest surviving law firm in New York City. I tried to discover from the Cram family. I tracked down a member of the Cram family, spoke to a Mr. Cram, who owns a portrait of Cram by John Singer Sargent, which was painted just about the time he was a trustee of this library. It's currently on loan to the Telfair Museum in Savannah, Georgia. No diaries, but a lot of letters exist. This Mr. Cram, whom I corresponded with, said he had a lot of letters relating to the purchase of books that Cram gave to the New York Society Library. I'm still in the process of talking with this gentleman. He does not have internet, he does not own a typewriter. We write longhand to each other. It's a different way of going about business. I'm still missing a lot of diaries. And so, as I've told many people, among the travelers, if I turn back to my notes here, if any of you have as ancestors a gentleman by the name of Robert W. Coakley, Lewis Stackpole, Ralph Izzard, James Augustus Dorr, James McHenry Boyd, Henry McVicker, John Ford, John Tucker, Samuel Whitlock, let me know. Thank you. I'm open to questions.
First of all, thank you for playing the character. And first of all, thank you so much for absolutely delightful, talking to Stephen. I can't wait to buy the book. And he hasn't paid me for this. but I was wondering, you said you started your research on the book about 6 or 7 years ago, if I'm not wrong. Were you, given the political stage in that part of the world, and certainly in Egypt, were you able yourself to travel to Egypt? And if so, were you able to find any information, lectures, correspondence there?
That's a good question. When I began working on this book, I began working on this book by transcribing the diary of Philip Rhinelander, which gave me a day-to-day sort of personal approach. I became Philip Rhinelander for a short time. Mm-hmm. I had been to Egypt beforehand, twice, once in the 1970s, and once as part of an expedition organized by the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., to see whether an exhibition of the Ptolemies might be appropriate. And so we traveled with staff from the British Museum and the National Gallery to look at, this was 15 years ago.
So I know
parts of the geography. I'm not an Egyptologist and a great deal of Egypt. I've also been up the Nile to look I corresponded with Cairo every day. The office of the AUC Press is on Tahrir Square. There were many days in which they could not go to work.
Mm-hmm.
The book was published during the most difficult time. It always looks more dangerous when you're here rather than when you're there. When I moved from New York City to Washington, people said, you're in the Washington, one of the most dangerous cities in the East Coast. And when I got to Washington, they said, you've just come from New York, one of the most dangerous cities.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
You familiar with a book that just came out a year or so ago about early travel? Really, the history of the formation of Thomas Cook and Son Company. I think the Golden Age of Travel, I can't remember quite the name, and I can't remember the name of the author.
I know of the book, I've not read the book.
It's absolutely magnificent. It's chock a block full of vintage photos from Cook's archives and the author's own archives. And in fact, I've just reviewed it for Tennant, the Modern Journal of Ancient Egypt.
Which I do look at. So I will read
it. The winter issue is due out in November.
I will make a point of it.
My name is David Moyer. I write for the magazine. I am an Egyptologist and visit Egypt for many times. But this, I think he wrote an earlier book on the iconic hotels, like Shepherd's, the Winter Palace, the Cataract, etc.
And all those hotels were built just after the period I'm writing about. Because one of the things I talk about, I have a chapter devoted in my book to how you traveled, where you stayed, what about letters of credit, what about letters of introduction. What kind of medical treatment did you have to get before you went, such as smallpox?
Well, Cook was the first one to start group tours.
That's right. None of my travelers, they all travel alone. Somebody asked me earlier today, how many servants did they take with them? Americans did not take servants with them.
Mm-hmm.
They picked up a dragoman, an interpreter, when they arrived, or usually in Malta, because many of the fragments were Maltese. And then once you got to Egypt, you went to the consul, John Glidden, and he helped you find a crew for a boat. But the people went alone. If an American went alone, he often looked for English companions to travel with him.
For the letters and diaries of those early travelers, I'm also an expert on L. Frank Baum, author of Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Who traveled on the grand tour of Egypt in 1906, and they went with Thomas Cook. And his wife wrote letters home, which he published privately. But they're absolutely marvelous. Humorous of her feeling about dragging in the American feeling about the Egyptians.
Well, somebody asked me once, what are you going to do now? Is it going to be a volume two? No, the answer is no. I have written my piece on Egypt. Sir, yes, Chris.
So, Drew, is there anything in these diaries and documents about the reaction of these Americans traveling to a place where there are colors in charge? You know, some of the Egyptians, some of the senior Egyptian officials and military men were black, and that must have been later with Mark Twain in the Innocents Abroad, they certainly expressed surprise at seeing.
Well, I do have several passages on the reactions of, this is, what was the reaction of Americans to seeing blacks? Both black officials, but also black slaves being shipped down from Sudan in huge quantities on boats to be sold in the slave markets in Cairo. A slave trade that essentially went on until 1885. And I have two passages which I will not read to you but mention. One written by a planter from Natchez who was traveling with his father to see how they grew cotton. And he saw nothing wrong in the slave trade because they could be converted to Christianity. And at the same time, I have a clergyman from Boston who thought it was just perfectly horrible. I've been reading a diary of a Charlestonian lady written in 1859, about 2 years before the outbreak of the American Civil War, in which she's traveling with her husband on the Nile. did the consuls have any friendship with the Egyptians?
No.
Yes.
No, we went. I went to Egypt with the people. I'm wondering.
Yes. Not so much the Americans, because there was not really an American presence. There was no there were no American missionaries in Egypt in the time of my book. There was no American trade because it was monopolized by the British. But if you lived in Alexandria, you probably belonged to the local horse club and you rode horses with all of the European compatriots and well-to-do Egyptians. There were a great many people who had the ear of the Pasha. Not so much Americans. Americans always went for an audience with a Pasha, but they always had to go through. They had to go through Glidden, or they went through the British consul. And the British, the Pasha was dependent on the Europeans for building his ships, for doing his medical services, for setting up the mail systems. So there was a lot of interaction at that point, but it did not include Americans.
How long did the quarantine go on?
Quarantine was set up for a variety of purposes. One reason for setting up quarantine was cholera, which came in from India about 1832, 1833, about the time that Radwan was setting up the new passage in India. There was a French doctor named Clot, C-L-O-T, who received fairly quickly the title Bey, so he was known as Clot Bey. He knew that cholera was not contagious. He knew it was infectious, but not contagious. So Clot Bey said there is no reason for quarantine whatsoever, because you cannot catch cholera from people. You catch cholera from bad water. He didn't know it was water at the time, but he knew it was something else. Yes. So there were lots of ways to avoid quarantine. Yes, it might be 2 weeks of quarantine. You generally could not avoid quarantine when you went back to Malta or went to Greece from Egypt. But coming into Egypt, you usually go to the consul and make an arrangement and have yourself put in a nicer quarters and get out of quarantine earlier. Mm-hmm. Many Americans, including Philip Rhinelander, who found themselves forced to be in quarantine in Greece. They didn't want to be in the lazaretto, as they were called, in the Syra, which was already then a cross-segmental place for ships. They opted to go to the Piraeus. And there they paid servants to come into quarantine with them to help take care of them while they were there for a few days. And the American missionaries in Athens would come and visit them and hand them books on tars, so it's not too close to them. There was no problem with this. There was plague, there was bubonic plague. That was no problem. That was fleas, of course.
I'd like to know a little bit about how you discovered the diaries that you use in your book. Especially, it sounds like you got some from the trade, some from libraries, and then personal contact. But
well, I would say that I began buying books in a very serious way in the mid 1960s, and so I saw a lot of. I saw a lot of bookstores, I saw a lot of catalogs. I bought everything that came my way, a huge amount. I only bought one diary. I have a diary of an Englishman who went up the Nile. I discovered that the other half of the diary is owned by the Brooklyn Museum. I have the part that takes this person down the Nile. The Brooklyn Museum owns that half of the diary, takes this individual up the Nile. And at one time, when I knew the late curator at the Egyptian Department, Bernard Bothmer, said, "You've got half the diary, I've got half the diary, let's put a price on it and we'll toss a coin." He just couldn't do it. He had this, I got it. How did I find the diaries? In the last 10 years, you can use all kinds of keyword searches in databases. then also personally went and visited libraries up and down these coasts and made a huge number of telephone calls. What do you have? What does the Manichee have? What does Mendo Theological Seminary have? And I found diaries that way. So, and you, it's remarkable. Once you go on some of these databases that are available at good libraries, you can find out extraordinary things. Every newspaper that was thrown away was kept by the American Antiquarian Society in Worcester, Massachusetts. It's all word searchable on a database. Mm-hmm. And you can put in phrases like American, Nile, traveler, up comes things. Sorry, Bernard, that's cheating, but I did that. Yes, in the back, right back.
I think it's interesting that you've ended the book when the camera was invented. And at the same time, the exact same era, there were American artists who were fascinated with the Alhambra and drew it along with the Brits. Did you find any American artists, great time for American art, right, going to draw or paint the Nile?
If only. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I have to qualify that answer, because the cover of the book shows John Lowell of Boston in a watercolor on his travels in the Mediterranean. What John Lowell did, because he had the wit and had the money, stopped off in Rome, and he went to the French Academy, and he said to the director of the French Academy, who is your best watercolorist? Mm-hmm. I want to hire him for a year to come to me. And so he hired Charles Blair. All of the watercolors that Charles Lear made of people and ruins and a couple of John Lowell are still owned by the Lowell family. They're on deposit in the Fine Arts in Boston. And Lear himself became a wonderful artist. There's going to be a show on him at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris this coming spring. But he's the only artist who really made interesting pictures that you can relate to an American traveler. I've looked at these diaries. You sort of wish every third page had a nice picture of a camel. Yes, there it is.
Is there something that in your research truly surprised you that came totally unexpected and amazed you?
How was I surprised? I was surprised, I think, by the detailed accounts that people kept. We don't keep accounts like that now. I was also surprised by the amount of time that people spent there. I looked at diaries and accounts of people who traveled in that part of the world in the 1850s and 60s and 70s. They were in a hurry. They were in Egypt for 5 days. These people were in Egypt for 2 months. It was completely leisurely. They had all the time on their hands. If you went across the Atlantic by sailing ship, it took twice as long as by a steamship. And you stayed away a year and a half. You started off in Paris. You learned a little French. You went to Rome. You saw the great sights there. And what really surprised me, I think, was the amount of time that people spent on their travels. I learned a lot. How they travel, I don't think that surprised me so much. But that's a good question, though. Yes?
Well, they can make a sense of time so different.
I'm reminded of William Kentridge's presentation at the Brooklyn Academy of Music that some of us saw last Saturday night. Time. Photography can stop time. It surprised me that Daguerre's announcement of photography was made at one of the great French academies, I think in August of 1839. He prepared the building, he had all the equipment ready, he had the chemicals ready, and people set out immediately. So in November of 1839, two photographers who actually called themselves daguerreotypists, both French, arrived in Alexandria on the same boat. One was from Quebec. So the very first photograph that I have of Egypt, the first photographs of Egypt were made. totally new to me. And the minute you have photographs, you have something else. And you begin to have a lot of Americans in the 1850s and 60s brought photographic equipment with them. How much time do I have for me? One more question? Yes. Philip Randander kept quite detailed accounts, not only of what things cost, but how much they ate. and I've not really translated it into modern terms. There is a travel guide published in 1835 how much it cost to go from Marseille to Malta to Athens to Alexandria, first class, second class, how much one were to pay if you brought your dog. There's a lot, and there's even a statement there, which I mentioned in the book, how much does it cost to ship a giraffe from Alexandria? they're all good accounts, and I would have to concede that I've not made much of it.
I'm going on the assumptions that most, if not all, of the travelers in those times were, you know, had money.
They had money. the Cram family, Philip Rhinelander, his two colleagues, they used an American banker in Paris. They had letters of credit in Athens, Constantinople. They used John Glidden as a banker. They carried both letters of credit and they carried gold sovereigns or gold louis in some quantity, which they then left in Alexandria against the promissory notes.